As he approaches the house, his hands fidget at his side. He needs her to say yes, and he already knows she's going to have more questions than he has answers for. He can already feel the anger burning in his gut as he thinks of her denying him. She has so much, he thinks. She won't even miss it. But even as he knocks on the door, he already knows he's willing to do whatever it takes to get what he wants. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 197, The Murder of Romee van Rooyen. This episode is sponsored by the brand new release movie, Not Without Hope. I've mentioned before how I really enjoy movies that are based on real life events, and this film is one of those. As true crime consumers, we're often faced with stories in which, at some points, all those involved really have left is a shred of hope. The events on which this movie is based are a perfect encapsulation of that. When four friends head out on a deep-sea fishing expedition, it's meant to be a fun day out with like-minded buddies, enjoying the sun, sea, and their shared love of angling. But when an unexpected storm hits, the young men's lives are quite literally turned upside down as their boat capsizes. Now, the group must fight 14-foot waves, freezing water, dehydration, and perhaps the deadliest of all, quickly fading hope that they will be rescued in time. Starring Zachary Levi, Josh Duhamel, and Joe Beth Williams, and directed by Joe Carnahan, Not Without Hope releases in cinemas today, the 5th of December, and it really is a must-watch. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. TCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform, and if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za and support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. Shoutouts to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Simone, Catherine Willis, Susan Feldman, Belinda van Sale, Linka, Belinda Delaray, and Danny Pearson for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. This episode was first published in the Patreon feed in February 2025. When someone dedicates their entire life to the pursuit of justice and then end up having their life taken in a way that is so similar to so many of the cases they spent their careers investigating or adjudicating, the case takes on a different slant. Over the last few years, it's become clear that organized crime is taking a strong foothold in South Africa, and it's impacting the justice system, sometimes very directly, by the targeting of police officers, members of the judiciary, and witnesses. This is especially true in the Western Cape, where street gangs have become deeply aligned with organized crime syndicates, and their members are often used as hitmen by crime bosses. So whenever someone involved in the justice process is murdered, this aspect often springs to mind. This case, though, would go from there to somewhere very different. In researching this case, I used an episode of Heiskenoot Vare Levens Dramas, several media articles, some information off social media, and statements issued by various government departments throughout the investigation. So, let's get into episode 197, The Murder of Romee van Rooyen.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Romee van Rooyen was born on the 29th of July 1969. She grew up with her dad, Roman, mom and siblings in Mitchell's Plain, and attended a local high school. Despite the difficulties of growing up in apartheid South Africa as a member of the coloured community, who'd been forcibly removed from their homes and relocated to the area which would become the Cape Flats, Romee grew up with a deep sense of community and family. Perhaps the injustice of those times and witnessing the struggles that those around her faced played a role in Romee's decision to study law at the University of the Western Cape and eventually go on to work as a state advocate for some time and then a magistrate. During her time as a prosecutor, Romee did a lot of work in juvenile court and then went on to focus on sexual offences cases. It was here that her particular combination of professionalism, authority, calm demeanour, and deep empathy came to the fore. Romee prosecuted and worked as a magistrate in Khayelitsha, Mitchell's Plain, Somerset West, and Simonstown. She was particularly proficient in working in low-income areas. She came at the cases with an understanding of what it's like for both victims and perpetrators to grow up and live in poverty, and the particular impact this can have on crime and trauma. Romee never married or had any children of her own, but she was brilliant at communicating with child victims, setting them at ease in the clinical setting of the court, and making them comfortable enough to share their often traumatizing accounts. When Romee's siblings began to have children, she shone in her role as an aunt too. And as one of the most successful members of her family, she became an emotional and often financial role model and assistance for many of her family members. Often, working in any sort of law enforcement role can be a lonely job. There are things you experience at work that you simply cannot or don't want to burden your family with. This often means that your bond with colleagues will be stronger because they're in the same position and can be trusted. It's clear Romee took the line between her professional and private lives very seriously. Her colleagues, even those who counted themselves among her friends, knew very little about her family or her life at home. And on the other side of that, her family knew nothing about the cases she prosecuted or presided over. Occasionally, they'd see her name in the newspaper when it was a headline-grabbing case, and they'd proudly mention it to her. Romee would just smile, accept their pride for her achievements, but share absolutely nothing about the cases themselves. She had a deep responsibility to the victims and the accused, and to justice as a whole, and there was nothing that could sway her from that. This separation of work and home life for those dealing with criminals on a daily basis is, of course, also a protection mechanism. The less everyone knows about the people and the things that matter most to you, the less those with nefarious intentions can find the ways to really hurt you. While many of Romee's fellow prosecutors and magistrates would later say they don't really feel a lot of fear in their work, most acknowledge that the danger does exist that an accused or their cohorts will come after you. During Romee's time in the sexual offences court, she sustained a gunshot injury to her leg. The information would be revealed in parts by her brother much later on, and he would say that his sister had instructed him to never speak about it publicly. There's no information available about what exactly resulted in Rame being shot, but from the context in which it would be discussed, which I'll talk about later, it was clear that this was somehow related to her work. In searching to try and find information about this incident, I realized just how many prosecutors and advocates have in fact been targeted over the years in what appear to be hits. Many of these cases have remained unsolved. Also in researching, I stumbled upon an interesting and tragic coincidence. Rame van Rooyen was the prosecutor who successfully prosecuted Johannes de Jager in 2014 for the murders of Charmaine Marais and Hiltina Alexander. That is the case I covered in episode 1 of True Crime South Africa, the very first case that started this whole journey. It was Rame who worked tirelessly to ensure that the murder of Hiltina got added to the case against Diaga, and that he paid with a life sentence for both the murders. After beginning her work as a magistrate in 2016, Rame moved between various districts until in 2021 she was appointed to a permanent role in Vredenburg on the West Coast. She happily accepted the post, but soon realized that with Cape Town traffic, the drive from her home in Marina da Gama to Vredenburg and back every day was going to be too much. So she decided to rent a small furnished apartment in Langebaan, where she would live during the week, and then on weekends she would go home to Marina da Gama. This arrangement proved to work really well for her, and Rame settled into a new position and made a huge impression on her colleagues in Vredenburg. On Friday the 9th of September 2022, Rame spent the last few hours of her day at work catching up on paperwork. At tea time, she sat at a table in the canteen with a group of colleagues, each nibbling on a muffin and sipping on a coffee. For one of her colleagues, a fellow magistrate, it was the first time their paths had crossed in the canteen. He later spoke about enjoying chatting with Rame in a more relaxed setting. He could have no idea how that seemingly innocuous moment would later be seared into his memory, for all the wrong reasons. That afternoon, as was her routine, Rame drove straight home to Marina da Gama from Vredenburg. Each Friday, she would lock up her Langebaan apartment for the weekend in the morning before work, and then leave for Marina da Gama straight after work to get ahead of the Friday afternoon traffic. That afternoon, as she drove home, Rame was likely thinking about her weekend plans. She'd arranged to pick up one of her nephews on Saturday. They were going to have coffee and a chat. Rame often acted as a pillar of wisdom for her nieces and nephews. They looked up to her, and she did her best to guide them into what she hoped would be bright futures, where they, as she had, could live happy and successful lives, doing something they loved. That coffee appointment would come and go, though, and Rame did not arrive to collect her nephew that Saturday afternoon. This was incredibly strange for Rame, who was always on time and never failed to do what she'd promised to do. When she didn't arrive, her nephew phoned her, but the calls went straight to voicemail. This, too, was completely unlike her. She never missed a call from one of her family members outside of working hours, and if she did, she always called back. But this time, she didn't. After a few hours of trying to get hold of Rame, her sister Tanya accompanied their father Roman, who had a spare set of keys to Rame's house, to a home in Marina da Gama to see if she was okay. She lived alone, and they were concerned she may have fallen ill and not be able to get to her phone. Tanya and Roman drove from Mitchell's plane to Marina de Goma. When they arrived at Romay's house, they were unsure whether they should go in. Her car was not in the driveway. Perhaps she'd had to remain behind in Friedenberg and just hadn't had the chance to let anyone know. But the pair couldn't leave without checking the house. After one last phone call to Romay went unanswered, they got the house keys out of the car and started to unlock the front door. Inside, the house was quiet. Tanya and Roman called out to Romay, but there was no reply. The curtains in the lounge were drawn back, the weak afternoon light flooding in. A window was open slightly to air out the room. Romay had to have been home. She wouldn't have left the curtains and the window open when she left for Friedenberg. It was only a few more seconds before they saw her, though. Just a few steps from the lounge into the hallway, which would lead to Romay's bedroom. And there she was, laying on her back on the floor, not moving. The next few minutes and hours must have passed in a blur. Police and ambulances were called. Paramedics knew from the moment they approached Romay's body that she had not just fallen down. Romay had been dead for many, many hours. The news was passed on to her family, who'd begun to gather outside. Romay was beyond saving. She was gone. At first, her family were unsure what had happened. Tanya and Roman had seen no visible injuries on her body, no blood to say she'd died a violent death without a doubt. So for a little while, they allowed themselves to think that perhaps she'd died naturally. A heart attack, maybe. Something that, while terribly sad, could be explained, and maybe unavoidable. When Romay was identified as a magistrate, the police in attendance immediately knew that this would be a case they'd need to tick all the boxes on. So a pathologist was asked to attend the scene. From the moment he looked at Romay's body, he was certain that this was no natural death. He immediately spotted bruising around her neck. He would later determine the bruising to be consistent with manual strangulation. Someone had wrapped their hands around Romay van Rooyen's neck and squeezed until she stopped breathing. And she hadn't gone down without a fight. Injuries on her hands, arms, and face showed that she had fought her attacker. Roman and Tanya explained to the police that they'd let themselves into the house, but the door had been locked as normal. There had been nothing on the outside of the house to tell them that anything was wrong. They hadn't touched anything else. There were no broken windows, no damage to the entrance to the home. Romay had to have opened the door to her killer. And then, after they'd killed her, they'd locked the door behind them. Only two things were missing from Romay's home. Her family said that she had a habit of always carrying some cash, and there was nothing in her purse. So that had been emptied. And her car, a white Toyota RAV4, was missing from her driveway. As soon as Romay's death was deemed a murder by the pathologist, police swung into action. CCTV from the roads around her home in Marina de Goma was obtained, which showed her coming home from work on Friday afternoon. Shortly after she'd arrived home, another car drove into her street. It stopped a few blocks from her house, and a man got out and walked to Romay's house, while the car that had dropped him off left the area. The camera footage was not high resolution enough to see the man's face, but the man did not leave on foot at any time. And in the early hours of Saturday morning, Romay's car was seen leaving Marina de Goma. She was not in the driver's seat. but a man who looked very much like the one who'd been dropped off and walked to her house earlier was. As news broke of Romea's murder, her colleagues and extended family were in shock. A friend who worked with her describes getting ready for church that Sunday morning and seeing a news headline notification come up on her phone. It stood out to her because of the word magistrate in the headline. She clicked on it and says that the first time she tried to read it, nothing on the page made any sense. She understood the words, but the context, her friend's name being next to the word murdered, was inconceivable. She passed the phone to her husband and asked him to read it. As he read the article out loud, her world began to crumble. The intentional divide that Romea had created between her home and work life was very evident in the days after her murder. Journalists attempted to get statements from both her family and her work colleagues, and it soon became clear that there was no crossover between the two, and certainly her work colleagues had no idea how to contact her family to extend their condolences or request permission to hold a memorial service with her colleagues. Romea's family were not in a space where they could speak much with the media. They were deeply grieving, but they also understood that the investigation was at a sensitive stage and they didn't want to say something they shouldn't. At first, investigators weren't sharing very much with the family either, because they realized early on that Romea had likely known her killer, so they had to be really careful. A few days after Romea's murder, though, Minister of Police at the time, Becky Tele, met Romea's father and brother outside her home and spoke with them and the media, assuring them of the police's best efforts. At that time, her brother shared with the media that although the evidence pointed to the killer being someone close to Romea, they also couldn't count out the possibility that this had something to do with her work. He mentioned briefly about the previous gunshot incidents. He also spoke in glowing terms of his sister's role as a prosecutor and then a magistrate, and described her murder as not just an attack on an individual, but an attack on the judiciary as a whole. Becky Tele agreed with him, and within a few days, if Romea's killer was watching, they'd see an unexpected turn of events, which would likely have sent a chill of fear down their spine. Because of what Romea did for work, her murder was considered a crime against the state. And there's a specific unit within the Hawks called CATS, Crimes Against the State, which deals with just those cases. Suddenly, Romea van Rooyen's killer was being hunted by some of the best investigators the country had to offer. After Romea's autopsy, during which it was confirmed that she had died of asphyxiation due to manual strangulation, her remains were handed back to her family, and they were able to lay her to rest. There were several different memorial services for Romea, but her main funeral was a deeply touching event, where for the first time, her work and home lives combined to celebrate her life. Romea's family was very large, with the van Rooyen side and then also her sister's husband's side, the Hartzenbergs, who were also very close with Romea. To include all of her nieces, nephews, cousins, and other family members and let them pay tribute, there were several groups of pallbearers who carried Romea's casket in and out of the venue. Her co-workers played their role by all attending in their full judicial robes. In an incredible moment of respect, the prosecutors, magistrates, and judges formed a guard of honour as Romea's casket was carried into and out of the church. One of her colleagues also performed a symbolic handing over of Romea's robes to her father, who had to be supported to stand in his grief. The moments left not a single dry eye in the crowd, and only reinforced the call for the committed magistrate's killer to be caught. Finding Ramey's vehicle had been a key element of the investigation, and it would emerge that the white Toyota RAV4 had been located, quite by chance, the day after her murder, and just 5 hours after her body was found. On the Saturday, a traffic officer had been driving down Jake's Havel Drive near the Singalo informal settlement on the outskirts of Mitchell's Plain, when he'd spotted a vehicle that appeared to have been abandoned with its hazard lights on. The vehicle was later confirmed to belong to Romain. Her house keys for her apartment in Langebaan were still in the vehicle, and the car's key was in the door. While the car was transported to the police station for forensic testing in the hopes of getting fingerprints or trace DNA, investigators tried to determine how significant its location could be. It would be easy to assume that finding the vehicle near the Singalo informal settlement meant that Romain's killer was from there, and that could certainly be one line of investigation. But from experience, police knew that if this murder had been about robbery, that vehicle would never have been found. It would have been taken to a chop shop and stripped within an hour or two of it being stolen. The fact was, as well, that the vehicle was also on the road to Mitchell's Plain. So, perhaps, the killer lived there and had left the vehicle near the informal settlement to throw them off. Further investigation into cameras in the area between Marina da Gama and where the RAV4 was eventually found showed this to be the more likely scenario. The vehicle was, at first, driven to a shopping centre in Mitchell's Plain, where it was left overnight. Then, the next day, the day that Romain's body was found, the individual who'd left the car in the shopping centre car park got back into it and drove it to the spot on Jake's Havel where it was found. While none of the footage helped to identify the killer's face, it did show from body structure, clothing, and the way he walked that it was very likely the same person who had been dropped off at Romain's house on Friday afternoon. This case would end up being so sensitive in terms of those close to Romain that much of the evidence about who gave police information about which people to look into would be kept quiet. But it became clear very soon that the investigation was not taking police very far out of Romain's immediate circle. And 19 days after her murder, the CATS unit of the Hawks made an arrest which would shock everyone. While the arrested person could not be named until he appeared in court, headlines blazed about an individual who had been arrested in Mitchell's Plain. He was just 18 years old and still lived with his parents. Then, on the 29th of September, a name which was very familiar to Ramey's family was made public, when Cassidy Hartzenberg appeared in court. 18-year-old Cassidy was Ramey's nephew, the son of her sister Tanya, who had found her body. Cassidy had not been the same nephew who'd had a coffee date arranged with Ramey on that Saturday. Journalists who had covered the story from the beginning also knew the name. They recognized it from Ramey's funeral brochure. Cassidy was one of the pallbearers, and his name was printed on the pamphlet. There were also pictures of Cassidy, sitting in the front row of the church beside his mother and grandfather, his head bowed as speaker after speaker spoke of his deceased aunt's virtues and called for the swift arrest of her killer. During Cassidy's first appearance in court, none of his family members were present. His parents would attend future hearings, and although they did their best to avoid speaking with the media, the pain in their expressions was clear. From the start, the media reported that Cassidy was a drug addict who had killed his aunt when she'd refused to give him money, which she believed would be used for drugs. His dad would eventually tell a journalist that he would have known if his son was a full-on drug addict, and although he couldn't discount that he may have used drugs occasionally, he didn't believe Cassidy had a serious enough drug problem to result in murder. Even though the young man was behind bars and would eventually abandon his bail application, the investigation was still ongoing, and physical evidence such as DNA and fingerprints were being processed, and witnesses were being rounded up. And so the young man who had left school before he'd completed matric and didn't seem to have much direction in life after that, spent his first Christmas in prison. And the Hartzenberg and Van Rooyen families spent the first festive season trying to navigate a horrifying situation. As the new year rolled in, Cassidy appeared in court on the 16th of February 2023 for a pre-trial hearing, during which the state told the judge that they believed the young man had premeditated the murder of his aunt. The case was moved to the High Court in Cape Town and set for its next hearing in March. More information about the crime came to light during the hearing, and the state said that Hartzenberg had borrowed 50 rand from someone that day and had paid that money to a friend to drop him off at his aunt's house. He had promised that friend an additional 150 rand the next day, presumably from money he intended to get from his aunt. A family member sitting in court that day was approached by a journalist, and they expressed that they simply couldn't understand how Cassidy could be guilty of the crime, saying that the young man had actually been one of Romay's favourites of the nieces and nephews in the family, and although she spoiled all her young family members from time to time, she had always given special attention to Cassidy. By July 2023, Cassidy Hartzenberg had been referred to Falkenberg Psychiatric Hospital for evaluation. Some of his statements and behaviours had raised red flags for the court of a possible attempt at a mental health defence, with Cassidy claiming to have no memory of the night in question, and he'd also expressed suicidal ideations. Some of Romay's family members publicly said that this was infuriating to them, and they didn't know what game the boy was playing at. For many years now, these vital forensic psychiatric assessments have become more and more delayed, with fewer beds available for those awaiting trial. When Cassidy was referred for his assessment, he was number 103 on the waiting list. By the time all the required bits and pieces were in place, the proceedings had dragged into 2024. By that point, though, a lot had changed. Devastatingly for both the Hartzenberg and Van Rooyen families, in December 2023, Tanya Hartzenberg, Romay's sister, and Cassidy's mother, passed away. I noted that this was not reported on in the media, and when I looked into it, it became very clear that the family had done their best to keep Tanya's death out of the public eye. Tanya's death was described as unexpected, and in the death announcement on social media, mourners were advised that there would be a memorial, but it would be short, and people were asked to respect the family's privacy and not ask questions. It was also noted that there would be no attendance at the burial site after the memorial. I have no idea what happened to Tanya, but I cannot even begin to fathom what she, as a mother, daughter, and sister, had gone through in the prior year. After the horror of finding her sister dead and then supporting her father through the grief of losing a child, just 2 weeks later, to watch her son be arrested for the crime, and deal with the fallout of that in the family. It's all just incredibly devastating. And now her father had lost another daughter. And Tanya's children, including Cassidy, had lost their mother. After everything the entire family had been through, I can absolutely understand them not wanting to have anything more about their pain in the public domain at the time, regardless of how Tanya died. Whether or not one had to do with the other, or if it was just a mass of terribly sad endings, by the time Cassidy returned to court in 2024, with his mother's place beside his father in court glaringly empty, he'd agreed to a plea deal with the state. Cassidy would admit his guilt to both murder and aggravated robbery. In exchange, the state would ask for a maximum penalty of 20 years behind bars. Now, the state still believed that the murder had been premeditated to some extent. Cassidy arrived at his aunt's house with a friend and didn't ask the friend to wait for him or come back. He knew he would have some other form of transport home. And he did. His aunt's car, which he stole after he murdered her. He'd also been sure that he would have money when he left his aunt's house, as he'd promised to pay his friend another 150 rand, and he could have no guarantee that his aunt would give him the money, unless he knew he would take it, regardless of whether she gave it freely or not. I am certain that the family ties here had something to do with the state relenting and agreeing to the guilty plea, despite Cassidy still claiming the murder was not premeditated. And I can fully understand that. This wasn't some stranger. It was a child born in the bosom of the family and raised there. And now both his aunt and his mother were dead within a year of each other, and I can't even begin to imagine them having to sit through a protracted trial in which everything would be brought right back up again. I did briefly wonder what Ramay, in her role as a member of the judiciary, would have thought of the sentence. Part of me wonders whether her time in juvenile court may have given her a perspective on juvenile offenders like her nephew, which would see the value in him receiving a sentence which may give him hope for the future. Another part of me thinks that what this world, this country, and she was robbed of in Romee van Rooyen deserved a harsher punishment. Cassidy Hartzenberg's plea statement detailed what he claimed happened on the night of his aunt's murder. Cassidy said he'd gone to Romee's house that afternoon to ask her for money because he wanted to attend a job interview in the following week. He claimed that his aunt refused, though, saying that he was only going to spend it on drugs and partying over the weekend. Cassidy alleges that when Ramay stood up from the lounge to walk to her bedroom after refusing him, he'd become enraged with her and grabbed her from behind around the neck. She'd fought back, but he'd continued to apply pressure to her neck until she collapsed and was no longer breathing. He said that when he realized he'd killed his aunt, he couldn't believe what he'd done, and he'd sat with her body for hours, debating on what to do. He'd then stolen cash out of her purse, locked the house up, and taken her car. He'd initially left the car parked at the Woodland Shopping Centre in Mitchell's Plain, but had gone back to move it to the spot on Jake's Hervil where it was found. Cassidy claimed that he'd cooperated with police after he was arrested and understood that his actions were wrong and he was prepared to face his punishment. Of course, this remorse only came after he'd struck a plea deal. Before that, he spent almost 2 weeks putting his family through the devastation of wondering who had killed Romain. He carried her casket. He sat in the church and comforted his family members and pretended to mourn his aunt. Then, after his arrest, he claimed to have memory loss over the night of the murder. Although Romain's colleagues were in part grateful that her murder had not been a hit or an act of retribution related to her job, they were equally gobsmacked that someone so young, who by all accounts had a great relationship with his aunt, could so cold-bloodedly kill her for absolutely nothing more than a couple of hundred rand. Of course, many had seen similar scenarios play out in their courtrooms before. But I think the human mind allows you to think that you might somehow be immune from that if you're on the other side of the bench or the badge. Perhaps it's necessary to think that, to continue doing the job. Because if you picture yourself or someone you love as the victim every time, there's just no way you'll get the job done. It was this separation of home and work that Romain had achieved so well, until the moment when the illogical, entitled rage of a teenager made all the parts of her life come crashing together in the most unthinkable of ways. I spent a lot of time thinking about why Cassidy would have done this. Perhaps his drug problem really was worse than he would admit to. Or maybe he's just one of those people who don't see the value in other human beings beyond what they can provide them with. When they stop providing, their usefulness is complete. Romain van Rooyen is quite a unique victim in that she understood the criminal mind. She'd worked with young offenders too, so she would have understood what the trajectory to crime as a young offender looked like. So I wondered whether she was blinded by her close relationship with Cassidy and chose to look past the warning signs. Or maybe there's another way to look at this. Everyone said that one of the things that made this so shocking was that Cassidy seemed to be Romain's favourite in many ways. She focused a lot of attention and resources on him. But in the aftermath of her tragic and senseless death, I wonder whether she was doing that because she did see the warning signs, and she knew that he needed guidance more than the others. After years of seeing examples day after day of the worst things human beings could do to others, maybe Romain died doing exactly what she was trained to do, taking action to guide errant human beings back onto the right path. Cassidy Hartzenberg will be eligible for parole in just 10 years. He will be 28 years old. He has the opportunity to continue his aunt's legacy of justice by proving that young offenders can be rehabilitated and become successful contributing members of society. That, after all, is all Romain wanted for him. And although she should never have had to pay with her life for that to happen, the future is in his hands now. He chose, and he gets to choose again. Whether he's going to be the boy who did the terrible thing, but chose to do the right thing every day after that, or if he's going to become the type of man his aunt would have sentenced to life for the good of society. Only time will tell which way it'll go. Romain van Rooyen, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify, or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.